I have an encouraging word for you this morning. If you have your Bibles, turn to Matthew chapter 14. If not, I'm going to read it. I'm going to start in verse 22. This is Jesus and the disciples are on the shores of the Sea of Galilee. This is where one of the times where there was a huge crowd of people gathered and Jesus was teaching. Teaching them, it says that there were 5,000 men besides women and children. So there was more than 5,000 people there. And this is where one of the times where Jesus told the disciples to feed the crowd. They took a few fish and a few loaves, multiplied the food, fed the crowd. Everyone ate and was full. And it says that they collected 12 basketfuls of leftovers. So there was more left over by far than what they started with, plus, you know, somewhere upwards of 7,000 people ate. And so that's what the context is. And then verse 22 says, immediately he, Jesus, made the disciples get into the boat and go ahead of him to the other side while he sent the crowds away. After he had sent the crowds away, he went up on the mountain by himself to pray. And when it was evening, he was there alone. But the boat was already a long distance from the land, battered by waves, for the wind was contrary. And in the fourth watch of the night, he came to them, walking on the sea. When the disciples saw him walking on the sea, they were terrified, and they said, "It is a ghost." They cried out in fear. But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Take courage, it is I. Do not be afraid." And Peter said to him, "Lord, if it is you, command me to come to you on the water." And he said, "Come." And Peter got out of the boat and walked on the water and came toward Jesus. But seeing the wind, he became frightened, and beginning to sink, he cried out, "Lord, save me." Immediately Jesus stretched out his hand and took hold of him and said to him, "You of little faith, why did you doubt?" Then they got into the boat, and the wind stopped, and those who were in the boat worshipped him, saying, "You are certainly God's son." So picture this. There's all these crowds. Jesus goes with the disciples to the edge, to the shore of the Sea of Galilee. They get in the boat. He tells them to go ahead and go across to the other side. It doesn't say that he's going to meet them there, but it seems like that's the assumption. So he's sending the crowds away. It says he's alone. It's evening, and he's praying up on the mountainside. Then it says that he sees the boat a ways off from the land, and that a storm has brewed up because there's wind and waves. And it says that it's the fourth watch, and there was the night watch in this time historically was divided into four watches. So the fourth watch is the last watch, so it's right before sunrise. So after they've been trying to cross the Sea of Galilee from whenever they sent the crowds away until almost sunrise. So the fourth watch is considered between 3 and 6 a.m. These are fishermen. It doesn't take that long to cross the Sea of Galilee, which indicates that it wasn't a light wind. These were not little waves. Like, they were struggling to navigate their boat across the Sea of Galilee. And Jesus, it says that he sees them, and then he goes to them, walking on the water. I think it's notable just to note that the waves make the sea impassable for the disciples, some of whom are fishermen accustomed to fishing in the Sea of Galilee. This is not a new situation for some of them. And yet Jesus can walk very quickly, apparently. He catches up to where the boat is by walking on the water. Of course, that freaks the disciples out, and they think he's a ghost. They cry out in fear, and Jesus reassures them, "Take courage, it is I. Do not be afraid." And then we see Peter do this bold thing, and he asks Jesus to call to him so that he can come. And he does that. He walks on the water. And I think whenever we look at this passage, we focus on the fact that Peter doesn't have perfect faith, right? It says, when he sees the wind, I think that's interesting because you can't really see wind, right? You see the effects of wind. When Peter begins to focus on the fact that the wind is creating these great waves, he begins to sink. And it says he cries out, and immediately Jesus puts his hand out and helps him. And so if Jesus was walking towards the boat and Peter asked that Jesus call to him, Peter was walking towards Jesus. And then at some point he begins to sink. Jesus helps him. And sometimes we stop there and Peter gets a bad rap. Let's keep going. Like, this isn't the footprints poem. Like, that's a beautiful sentiment, but I don't see that in the Bible. Like, Jesus didn't carry Peter to the boat. Like, it didn't end with Peter sinking. They walked back to the boat. And it was still stormy. The waves must have still been going because it says when they stepped into the boat, the waves stopped. And so I think sometimes Peter gets a bad rap in this. There's 12 disciples in the boat, and Peter's the one who says, "Hey, I wanna do what you're doing." Discipleship was a common thing in ancient days. There wasn't schools. Like, that's how people learned a trade. Discipleship was not a spiritual thing. Now that word discipleship is often used only in spiritual context. It was never originally a spiritual word. If you wanted to become a carpenter, you became a disciple of a carpenter. And you didn't read a book. You didn't watch videos. Like, you worked with a carpenter and they taught you the trade. And you didn't continue as a shepherd. Like, you quit what you were doing and you became an apprentice. You became a disciple of someone and you did what they did until you could do it as well or better than them. And then you were a carpenter or whatever in your own right. And so Jesus called these men, some of whom were fishermen. Peter was a fisherman. He called him away from what he was doing and said, "Come be my disciple. Learn from me. Do what I do." And I would propose to you that there's a boat full of disciples, but the only one who sees himself as a disciple in this situation is Peter. It wasn't that long ago, earlier in Matthew's account, it was just a few chapters back, the disciples were in the boat crossing the sea with Jesus, and the storm was so bad, but Jesus was sleeping. Do you remember that story? He's sleeping in the boat. The disciples are afraid. The storm is so bad, they think the boat is going to break apart and they're going to die. And they wake him up, and he stands up, and he commands the storm to be still. They've seen Jesus's power even over the weather, in a boat, on the sea. They've seen it. And here they're, we don't know. Had they tried to command the storm? Had they cried out to Jesus? I don't know. But Jesus' eyes were on them when they were passing, trying to cross the sea. And he was a distance. He was a ways from them, but it wasn't too far that he couldn't get to them. And as he's coming toward them in a unique way, they haven't seen him walk on water before. Peter is the one who says, "If you can do that, I can too." You know, he says, "Call to me that I would come to you on the water." And he does. And so I think here we see an example of Peter being a disciple. And Jesus calls out, he calls him up. Maybe Peter doesn't have as much faith as Jesus wants him to have. A little faith must be enough to walk on water. Just a little. He had enough. And Jesus helped him, and then they continued to walk in the storm back to the boat. And when they got in the boat, the waves stopped. What do you do when you face a storm, when you're in the midst of a storm in your life, and maybe you feel like you have just a little bit of faith? What do you do with it? Do you call out to Jesus? Do you do what he's doing? Do you go towards him? Or do you wait? I think one thing that the Holy Spirit's been speaking to me as I've been pondering this passage and others that I'm going to talk about is that I think Jesus, he will do miracles for us. He will act on our behalf. But I think his greatest desire, I think his purpose for mankind is that he would do miracles with us. Not for us. I think he will. I think he will intervene. I think he will break through. But I think what he wants more is that he would do miracles with us. And I think in this example, we see Peter participating in Jesus, in what Jesus was doing, walking on the water through the storm and stilling the waves as they returned. And now I want to, we're just going to kind of hold that picture in our minds, but I want you to turn to Hebrews. I'm going to read just a couple of verses. Hebrews chapter 11 and 12. In chapter 11 of Hebrews, we start with this definition of faith. And then the writer of Hebrews goes into these examples all throughout the Old Testament of men and women of great faith. And we often refer to that as the heroes of the faith or the hall of fame of faith in the Bible, where it says by faith, you know, Abraham sacrificed Isaac, has all these examples of men and women who demonstrated great faith. That's all of chapter 11. And then I want to read just the first two verses of chapter 12. The writer of Hebrews says, "Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who, for the joy set before him, endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God." Therefore, why is the therefore there? What is it there for? So he's saying, Hebrews 11:1 is the definition of faith. Now, faith is the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things not seen. Verse 2, "For by it the men of old gained approval." And then all these examples of great faith. And then he says, therefore, since we have this example, since we have this great cloud of witnesses, these people, men and women who have demonstrated great faith, it says, "Therefore, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which easily entangles us." Have you ever thought about if you were to go through chapter 11 of all of has all those examples of great faith, if you instead used those same people, that same list of men and women, but instead of looking at their moments of great faith, if you looked for what it talks about here in verse 1 of chapter 12, what if you looked for in all of those people the circumstances that could have encumbered them, or the sin that easily entangled them? It's quite a list. This is the heroes of the faith, but it's a mess if you look at that list. If you look at the list of the circumstances, the adversity they faced, or you look at a list of their sin, it's not pretty. You've got jealousy, betrayal, insecurity, doubt, outright disobedience, like people saying no to God, "I will do it my way." There's sexual sin, there's murder, there's lust, prostitution. Like, it's not a pretty list. Like, that's not a list of the heroes, but it is. "Since we have so great a cloud of witnesses, let us also..." So these men and women that are listed in the heroes of the faith, they set aside encumbrances. They set aside, let us set aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily tangled us, and let us run the race with endurance. That's what they did. And so if we think we have to have perfect faith and not any doubts at all in order to be counted among the great men and women of faith, we need to look no farther than right here. They set aside encumbrances. They persevered through sin. And it says, if you look back at the beginning of chapter 11, it says, by faith, the people of old gained approval. Their faith was enough to gain approval with God. Remember, the heroes of the faith lived before Jesus. And approval from God wasn't based on faith. Sacrifice was based on faith. God required that his people believe in him, but their approval was gained by righteous living And when they screwed up, they had to make sacrifices in order. There had to be something had to be perfect. And it wasn't their faith. They had to believe in God, but he said, here's the commandments. Live this way and you'll have my approval. The commandments were given as a guideline for righteous living, and sacrifice was the way that the disparity was made up. But these people, their faith gained them approval even before that was the part of the equation. So how is it that the writer of Hebrews would say to us, so, you know, therefore, since you are surrounded by these men and women of faith, you do it too. You run the race. You set aside the encumbrances. You set aside the sin that would easily entangle you and run the race with endurance that is set before you. And the key to how to do that is in verse 2, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. That's how we set aside the encumbrances. That's how we set aside the sin that would easily entangle us, by fixing our eyes on Jesus. Because the heroes of the faith didn't have Jesus. Their faith wasn't perfected. Ours is. And how is it that it's perfected? It says, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith. He's the author of our faith because he wrote the story. He's the one who did it. God from the beginning, right? He had this narrative set up that the way that the ways that we fall short of the standard would be accomplished in Jesus, because he would live as man, but perfect. And so his death, when he was resurrected from the dead, his sacrifice would be one and for all. No longer would there be a disparity that would need to be made up by a sacrifice. He's the author and perfecter of our faith. And he now sits at the right hand of the throne of God. And so if we fix our eyes on Jesus, we have what he has accomplished for us. And that enables our faith to be perfect. You're actually more qualified than the heroes of the faith for approval by faith. And your doubt can come along. Your sin can come along. It did for them. I think we would be hard-pressed to not find a sin that you or I would struggle with in the list in Hebrews 11. And we're not supposed to compare sin, but you should be encouraged if you look through the lives of these people, and yet we feel at times like we are disqualified from having enough faith. I think a little is enough, and your doubts can come too. Peter was the one who was hungry. He said to Jesus, I want to do what you're doing. His faith, it didn't have to be perfect. It wasn't perfect, but it was enough. And Jesus helped him when it wasn't enough. When he started sinking, all he did was cry out, and Jesus helped him. He didn't carry him. There were two sets of footprints in the water. They walked through the storm. He didn't take away the circumstances that were adverse to the crossing of the sea. But they got there, and together they did amazing things. They calmed the storm. When we fix our eyes on Jesus, we get the reward as well. It says Jesus did it for the joy set before him, and that he's sitting down at the right hand of the throne of God. Jesus endured storms too. He set aside encumbrances. He persevered through betrayal, scorn, loss, physical torture, false accusation, shame, and death. And he cried out to God and received help. God sustained him, just like God sustained the heroes of the faith, just like God sustains you and me. And we're rewarded with joy. We're rewarded with his presence. Because Jesus walked before us, we can walk towards him. And he's sitting at the right hand of the throne of God. And so when we are in the boat, in the midst of the storm, we put our eyes on him and we believe by faith that even though he feels distant, Jesus was on the mountain, but he could see the disciples. I wonder if they could see him. But he could see them, and it did not take him long to get there. He was on time. He was unhindered by the storm. And Peter got out and walked toward him because he had a little faith. What would he have done if he had a lot? I think I don't think it's about amount. Peter had a little bit and he had doubt, and it was enough for him to walk on water. I want to look at one more picture this morning. This is in Exodus chapter 13 and 14. If you can turn there. Otherwise, you guys all know this story. When, you know, the Israelites were being held captive. They were being oppressed by the Egyptians, and God was using Moses to bring about the deliverance of his people. And when we see in verse 17 of chapter 13 that Pharaoh, the leader of Egypt, has had enough of, you know, there was the plagues and all this stuff that happened, right? I'm not going to go into all of that, but Moses had been asking Pharaoh, let my people go. And, you know, they weren't going to give up their huge workforce. But after all these plagues and all this demonstration of power, God backed up Moses. Finally, Pharaoh's had enough. And not only does he just let them go, he sends them packing. He's like, go, please, and take your herds and your animals and your families with you. And so they're leaving. In chapter 13, verse 17, it says, now when Pharaoh had let the people go, God did not lead them by way of the land of the Philistines, even though it was near. For God said, the people might change their minds when they see war and want to return to Egypt. And so the people are on their way. God's leading them. That was the whole picture where it says that God led them at night by a pillar of fire and during the day by a pillar of clouds. And they're on their way to the promised land. God has promised that he's going to give them land that's abundant, especially compared to where they were living. Not only would they be free from captivity, but they would have land that was abundant. It said it was flowing with milk and honey, and that he would give it to them, but they have to get there. And here it says that the closest way would have been through the land of the Philistines, but the Philistines wouldn't have just let them, you know, tramp through their land. They would have had to fight them. And it says that God was concerned that if the people had to engage in war, they would want to go back to Egypt. And so he led them a different way. And we know the story. He led them to the Red Sea, and they get there. And in the meantime, Pharaoh has changed his mind. He's lost his workforce, and he's concerned. It says, then the Egyptians chased after them. This is starting in verse 9. Then the Egyptians chased after them with all their horses and chariots of Pharaoh, his horsemen and his army. They overtook them in the camp by the sea beside Pi-Hahiroth in front of, I don't know, something. As Pharaoh drew near, the sons of Israel looked, and behold, the Egyptians were marching after them. They became very frightened. So the sons of Israel cried out to the Lord, and they said to Moses, is it because there are no graves in Egypt that you have taken us away to die in the wilderness? Why have you dealt with us in this way, bringing us out of Egypt? Is it not the word that we spoke to you in Egypt, saying, leave us alone that we may serve the Egyptians? For it would have been better for us to serve the Egyptians than to die in the wilderness. But Moses said to the people, do not fear. Stand by and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you will never see them again forever. The Lord will fight for you while you keep silent. So they are they're between a rock and a hard place. They are up against the sea, the shores of the Red Sea, and they are going to camp there for the night. And then they turn and they see that the Egyptian army is after them in force. And they're afraid. They're so afraid that they're like, it would have been better. You know, we're going to die here at the wilderness. We could have been living in oppression, yes, but at least we would have been alive back in Egypt. Were there no graves in Egypt that we had to come out here to die? That's what they're saying to Moses. And Moses assures them. He says that God's going to fight for them and that they will never have to see the Egyptians again. But they're up against this impossibility, this great sea. And you guys know the story that God has Moses assemble the people, that they go up, Moses stretches out his hands, and as Moses and Aaron lead the people and they begin to walk into the sea, it parts and the waters they're stacked up like a wall, and they walk through on dry land. And then I'm just going to read, you guys know this, but it's cool to read what happens. They get across, all the people get across the Red Sea, and the Egyptians are following them because their intent to destroy them. Then the Lord says, I'm going to start reading in verse 26. Then the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand over the sea so that the waters come back over the Egyptians, over their chariots and their horsemen. So Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the sea returned to its normal state at daybreak, while the Egyptians were fleeing right into it. Then the Lord overthrew the Egyptians in the midst of the sea. The water returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen, even Pharaoh's entire army that had gone into the sea after them, the Israelites. Not even one of them remained, but the sons of Israel walked on dry land through the midst of the sea, and the waters were like a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. So the Israelites walk through, and they turn, and they watch as the water swallows their enemies whole. These were the people that had oppressed them. They had kept them as slaves. They were victims of their power, and they watched them be destroyed. Unfortunately, most of all but Caleb and Joshua die in the wilderness after this, right? And I believe that in this moment, what was on the line wasn't just their physical lives and the power of the Egyptian army, but also the identity of the Israelite people. It wasn't just the power of Pharaoh and his army that was pursuing them when they were on the Egyptian side of the Red Sea. It was also the identity as of slavery. The identity as oppressed people, the identity of being victims, was also pursuing them. And so the enemies were swallowed whole by the Red Sea when God, you know, performed the miracle and let the water come down. The people died, but the Israelite people didn't, their identity as captors, as victims, did not die when the Egyptian army was killed in the Red Sea. They held on to that identity, because when they sent the spies into the promised land and they came back, you know, the 10 spies, 12 spies went out and 10 came back saying, there's giants, we can't take it. What has God done? He's brought us here, but we can't take the land. And Joshua and Caleb came back having seen the same thing. They said, yeah, the land is amazing and there's people there and we will have to fight for it, but God gave it to us. And they will be our bread. They all saw, all 12 saw the same land, and it's both the beauty of it, but also what it was going to take to get it. And 10 still held on to this identity of being oppressed. They saw their new enemies, right? And God said, this was your land. Joshua and Caleb believed this. If this is our land, then God, if he's already given it to us, we just have to take it. See, they had taken on a new identity, but the other 10 spies were still hanging on to the identity of being victims, of being oppressed. I think this happens for us at times too. We're facing adversity. We're facing a mountain or a challenge, some adverse circumstances. And oftentimes we're like the Israelites, where we turn around. We think we're going toward the promise or what we feel like God's called us to, and we get to a challenge. And oftentimes, instead of walking through and believing that God's going to part the water, lots of times we turn around and we check. Like, did I make a wrong turn? Like, oh, all of a sudden I'm on the banks of something that's impassable. And we turn around like, did I screw up? Did I take a wrong turn? like how far have I come? And sometimes we see our enemy pursuing us and we get afraid. And sometimes it's actual events, you know, like in this case, it's chariots and an army of people. And they are the people that had oppressed them before. So it's not, you know, it's perfectly understandable why they were so afraid. But there was also an identity that was pursuing them. And I think sometimes that is also very true for us, that when we turn in the midst of facing adversity, we have a harder time giving up an old identity than we do embracing. What do we have more faith for? See, Joshua and Caleb had more faith in the promised land, in what God had given, in what he was taking them into. They had more faith for that than they did fear of the Egyptians. They had more faith for what God was doing than who they used to be. Let's apply that same thinking to Peter in the boat. Peter had been a fisherman. I think he was coming to a place in his discipleship, in his journey with Jesus, that he was having more faith for what Jesus was doing and what he was going to do, what Jesus was calling him into, than he had faith for being a fisherman, because he was willing to stop trying to navigate a boat. That's something he could do. And he got out of the boat and he said, I'm going to do something I've never done before. I'm going to go to Jesus. I'm not waiting till he gets to me. I want to go and meet him part way. He gave up an identity in order to embrace something that God was doing. The Israelites, their past ended up killing them one way or another. And they believed that. They believed more in who they had been than in what God could do, the miraculous. I think the main challenge from this message is, will you walk toward God in the midst of the promises that he's given you? Will you have more faith for them than you have faith for who you used to be or what God has done in the past or the adversity that's against you? Do you believe that he's always got his eyes on you? Even if God feels far, does he see you? Is he on his way to you? And do you let your past or your sin, your circumstances disqualify you? Think of those heroes of the faith. They screwed up. Some of them screwed around. Like, their lives were messy. They were full of sin. They had faith, and what the faith they had was enough. The little bit of faith that Peter had was enough. And his doubts were able to come along, and they were dealt with in the context of partnership. Jesus didn't disqualify him because of his doubts, but he met him in them. And together they had victory over the adversity that they faced. So I'm just going to read Hebrews 12, 1 and 2 again over you. This is like our charge, right? Like all of this, all of what's in Scripture is our inheritance. It's an indicator of who God is and what's possible, but it's also an indicator of who we are, who we're called to be. And this would be said over us. Therefore, since we have so great a cloud of witnesses surrounding us, let us also lay aside every encumbrance and the sin which so easily entangles us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of faith, who for the joy set before him has endured the cross, despising its shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. That's for you. That's a call for me. That's a call for you. And Jesus has already endured the cross and despised its shame. He's already overcome all that needs to be overcome. That's the fuel that we have when we endure the race, when we run, and we run towards him. We run towards a God whose eyes are always on us, no matter how far away we are, and no matter how severe the wind is, no matter how big the waves are. He sees us from the mountain top. He sees us and he's on his way. I think a promise for us to claim this coming week is that Jesus is always moving towards us. And we can sit in the boat and wait. We can be in the wilderness and camp out. Or we can walk towards him. Peter could have stayed in the boat and Jesus would have come. Maybe the waves would have calmed when he got into the boat. Just like the Israelites, they waited in the wilderness, and some of them, that's where they spent their life, right? 40 years wandering around because they didn't have enough faith to get into the promised land, because they were clinging to this identity that they were victims, that they were captors. Even though they're enemies, the people that held them captive had been taken care of. The identity had not been. And so we believe that God will do miracles with us. And in order to do that, we have to walk toward the promised land. We have to walk toward the promises, walk toward him, call out to him. If you can see me, call to me so that I can come towards you. That's what Peter said. If it's you, call to me so that I can come to you on the water. And he did. So I think just the question that I'm asking myself and that I'm asking you is, are you waiting or are you walking? And both, you can do both in faith. Are you waiting for Jesus to come and rescue you in the boat? Or are you going to take the little bit of faith that you have and your doubts and your screw-ups too, and ask Jesus to call to you so that you can walk toward him? And together you can walk on the water, still the storms, overcome the adversity. All right, well, if you would just stand, I want to just pray over us. Jesus, we just thank you. I just pray that your spirit would release the reality of these verses over us, not just over our minds that we understand or can remember, but over our spirit. Would you release the truth, the fullness of truth, that you, Jesus, are seated at the right hand of the throne of God, that you have endured all that you endured so that our faith would be made perfect in you. I pray that that would settle in our spirits, that our faith is made perfect by Jesus and what he has already done. And so there's a freedom that can wash over you, even in this moment, that there is no need for perfection on your part. We can be a people freed of the expectation of being perfect, because Jesus has made our faith perfect. I thank you, God, that your eyes are on us. No matter how far away it feels like you are, I thank you that you can see us. No matter how adverse the circumstances may be, no matter how great the storm, that you can see through it, you can see around it, over it, you can get to us, that it's not so great that you can't walk on top of it and get to us. I pray that you would encourage us, you would encourage our faith. I pray that we would know the truth, that our doubts or our mistakes don't disqualify us from being men and women of great faith. I thank you for the identity that we have as your sons and daughters, that we would stand up fully in that identity, and we would do what Hebrews chapter 12 calls us to, that we would run this race, that we would lay aside the things that could hinder us and the sin that could entangle us, and that we would set our hearts to endure towards you, that we would keep our eyes on you, that we would trust in your perfection so that we don't have to demand perfection of ourselves. I thank you that you are the one who reaches out when we call out to you, and you help us stand back up again, and you walk with us. I thank you that you are a God who will do miracles on our behalf. But I also thank you that you are a God who intends to do miracles with us. That it is your purpose and your joy to reveal your power through your people. And I thank you that we are your sons and daughters, that you love us intensely and fiercely, that you've not given up on us, and that you're calling us to not give up on ourselves. And I thank you for the promises and the destiny ahead of us. And I pray that there would be faith released today to pursue those promises, to believe in them more than we believe in our past identity, to believe more in what you're leading us into than what has defined us in the past. Just pray that you would remind us of the truth of who you are and who we are. I thank you that you call us victorious. I thank you that you lead us. Thank you that you will swallow our enemies whole. And pray that we would have the courage to leave our identities that any enemy would give us, that we would lay them down, that we would fully embrace who you say we are. Would you find us, God, to be men and women who are truly disciples of you? I thank you that the room is full of men and women of great faith. Yeah, and just pray that you would continue to use us to demonstrate that faith in the world. By your grace, God, and for your glory, we ask these things, and we seal your words in our heart and ask that your Spirit would remind us of them when we need to have courage. Amen.